we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover this week, starting with, it looks like, the wrap-up of the John T. Williams inquest.
Well, nearly the wrap-up. The jury came back with their answers to a whole bunch of questions in the inquest. Of course, from here, the King County Prosecutor's Office will have to take the answers to these questions and determine, after studying them for a couple of weeks, determine whether or not they're going to bring charges against Officer Burke. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the media coverage of it and what some of the actual questions and answers were. The media coverage came out saying, well, the inquest jury was split on whether or not there was a problem with Officer Burke's
Wrong.
Yeah. What actually happened is they were split over whether or not they haven't had enough evidence to rule that Officer Burke was in the wrong. I just want to read the questions and answers to a couple of these questions. One of them, one of the questions was, did John T. Williams have sufficient time to put the knife down after Officer Burke's order? And of the eight jury members, only one said yes. Four said no, and three said they didn't know. So to me, when a majority says no,
that, of course, assumes that Williams even heard the order.
Yeah, that's not a split. And that question was not asked.
Yes.
The jury, and so they were not able to answer it. Another question that was asked was, did Officer Burke believe that John T. Williams posed an imminent threat of serious physical harm to Officer Burke at the time Officer Burke fired his weapon? So it's basically asking, did Burke believe he was in danger? Of that group, four said, oh, yes, he did believe he was in danger, and four said that they didn't know. Nobody said no. That is a very interesting question. But then the next question is, based on the information available at the time Officer Burke fired his weapon, did John T. Williams then pose an imminent threat of serious physical harm to Officer Burke? In other words, was Burke paying attention? Did he pick up on all the clues he should have in order to determine whether Williams was a threat to him? And what the jury members answered, only one of them said, yes, he did pick up on the clues. Three said they didn't know, and four, a majority said no, he wasn't paying attention, he wasn't doing his job correctly. That's not a split decision, that's a majority decision. And I'm a little upset that the media didn't actually report this correctly.
Well, I mean, it's not surprising because, you know, their focus is going to be on the fact that, you know, there's never been any doubt cast in past inquest findings of this nature, where lethal force was used by law enforcement. I mean, the whole story was that the system cast any doubt at all whatsoever. But you can't, you know, the idea that because you had some jury members say they didn't know it. It doesn't rise to the standard of proving that something did happen, but it does tell you that it was highly problematic. The real issue with this is that the way that state and federal law is written, this is going to be almost impossible to prosecute Burke.
Yeah, that's true.
It's going to be very, yeah, I would be beyond astonished if Satterberg's office decided to press charges in this matter.
Yeah, if the King County Prosecutor's Office does come back and charge Burke, there's a question of what would they charge him with. There are various types of crimes they could charge him with, but the level of proof that they would have to uphold in order to get a conviction is so high that
basically you would have to prove that Burke acted with malice and forethought, I believe, too.
Yeah.
Depending on the charge, but definitely with malice, and you would have to prove that, not intuitive, but prove it, and that's almost impossible.
Yeah, that's true. On the other hand, the fact that the inquest jury came back with these kinds of results, something that we've probably never in this county seen before, is an indicator that there's something wrong at the Seattle Police Department and that an outside agency really should come in and take a look. It really supports the push by the ACLU and other groups and by which has been supported by now, as we talked about last week, been supported by people who are former prosecuting attorneys.
Well, you, I'm going to play devil's advocate for mm-hmm. a moment with that, because you know, yeah, as an absolute fact, that if the SPD does come back with its internal investigation, which its preliminary findings were leaked out, you know, pending the result of the inquest, jury, but the preliminary findings were that Burke did not have sufficient cause for the shooting. You know that SPD is going to come back and say, well, this was an unfortunate incident and an issue of a snap misjudgment on behalf of one officer. It in no way carries any kind of judgment that this is a systemic problem within SPD. This was an isolated incident.
Yeah.
And you know that's going to be the defense, and therefore you have to put this in the context of all the other incidents, almost all of them involving non-white suspects or non-white civilians who weren't even suspects, who have been attacked or abused or otherwise mistreated by SPD.
Mm-hmm. And it won't take into account the fact that also this week the SPD announced that they were opening an internal investigation into a complaint that some local media folks at Como Radio lodged, that they witnessed a suspect being punched after he was handcuffed and laying on the ground. It turns out that this suspect was an older down-and-out guy. In other words, they suspected him of being a homeless person, and he was being...
Which is a Class C felony, I believe.
Police chased him down, and he was not running. They actually pulled over their car, ran over, tackled him, his face hit the pavement, and then they handcuffed him. And then the Como radio person who was in her car watching this watched as police punched him two or three times in the face, because they believe he spat on them. Now, remember what led up to all this. The guy was jaywalking. Now, if I was jaywalking, I'd be given a ticket and sent on my way. This guy, because he looked like a homeless person, cops pursued him, tackled him, handcuffed him, and then began to punch him in the face. I mean, this really is showing a pattern here when they pursue people who are not middle class or upper middle class white folks, or people who appear to be homeless. That's something that I think really makes us have to say, is it worthwhile that the SPD is pursuing the broken windows policy? In other words, targeting people who don't look like you and me.
Well, the idea of broken windows, the theory mm-hmm. behind it is the idea that you prevent small crimes in order to not foster a climate in which larger crimes can occur. But the problem, of course, is that the way they're treating people who are suspected of these small crimes is itself a larger crime.
Yes.
So you're not preventing crime, you're perpetrating it.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Moving on, developments related to the tunnel, the Debord Tunnel.
Yeah, you know, the Fed sent a letter to the state this week saying that they had reviewed the environmental impact statement for the downtown traffic tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct. And it turns out that the tunnel's going to be running under a part of the federal building. Well, that's a problem because the design plans are so vague at this point that it appears the tunnel, the top of the tunnel, in one part of the environmental impact statement, says it's going to be 75 feet below the basement of the federal building, which puts it right at the base of the foundation piers of the federal building at 2nd and Marion downtown. But in another part of the environmental impact statement, it says the top of the tunnel could be at 46 feet below the basement, which would put it at the middle of the foundation piers for the downtown federal building. Right now, the federal building sits on timber piles, which at some point in the future are probably going to have to be replaced, right? Because wood rots, you know? But modern piles are usually driven far deeper than the current 75 feet that the timber piles have been driven. So the feds are saying, look, you know, in the future when we have to replace these foundation supports, we're not going to be able to do that if there's a tunnel, if there's a concrete tunnel underneath us.
Not to mention that you would think that having a tunnel directly underneath the federal building foundation would be a security issue as
Might be a security issue, yes. And the environmental impact statement also said that the tunnel would lead to, they were looking at the specific buildings it was going to run under, and they said in terms of the federal building, it could lead to 2 to 3 inches of settlement. Well, it runs under part of the federal building, and if part of the building settles, what is that going to do to the entire building? That could be a problem. So the feds were extremely concerned. They said the environmental impact statement raises a whole bunch of issues that have to be addressed before tunnel construction can go ahead. And I think it's very interesting because they basically came out and said that so far the design is vague enough that they don't have a clue how it's going to impact the foundation of one of the largest buildings it's going to run beneath.
I think the idea that you could have a settlement of only part of the building could lead to one of the more remarkable new monuments in downtown Seattle, which is the Leaning Tower of Bureaucrats.
All right. Moving on. It's last Monday, Martin Luther King celebration and marches in Seattle as well as in Spokane.
Yeah, and a very, very frightening story coming out of Spokane this week where a incendiary device, otherwise known as a bomb, was found on the MLK march literally just minutes before crowds were supposed to walk by there. Three city workers reported in, and the bomb squad removed, and the march was diverted. A bomb which, according to the FBI, had a remote-controlled device, shrapnel, and was placed against a brick wall to ensure that the force of the blast would be directed outward toward the marchers. An FBI source called it the most sophisticated device that we've seen in country, meaning, in other words, that this is the type of bomb that you often see IEDs in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in war zones. This was not something that you had normally seen before in the United States in terms of bombs. And because, of course, it didn't go off, this didn't get all that much media attention. It was remarkable. This was essentially an assassination attempt that was aimed at not just MLK celebrants, but basically the entire liberal and activist community in eastern Washington and northern Idaho, because, again, Spokane is sort of the liberal oasis of a very conservative outlying rural area, a catchment area of really a couple hundred miles in every direction. And the MLK march, you know, the Spokane and northeastern Washington and northern Idaho is one of the whitest areas of the country, and Spokane is one of the whitest major cities in the country. But you still have an MLK march. Pretty much every progressive activist of every type comes to that march, similar to how they do in Seattle and other cities as well. And this was an attack that was aimed at them. You also had a similar, although smaller, bomb that was found last March, on March 28, 2010, at the Spokane Federal Building. So this is something that's happened more than once, and this is somebody out there who's doing this. This is an act of domestic terrorism, and you know perfectly well that if this had been the sort of a target that was, say, could be plausibly linked to an Islamic extremist group, this would be headlines across the country for days, if not weeks. You'd have the Department of Homeland Security scrambling to institute new measures to prevent this sort of thing. Instead, it's just business as usual. And it's very, very disturbing and frightening that in a month in which we've been talking endlessly about the effects of violent rhetoric and a hateful political climate in the wake of the Tucson massacre, that you can have an incident like this and it still gets almost no media attention.
Yeah, and what I was thinking when I was reading about this was not only is Spokane in the heart of a high concentration of white supremacist groups that exist in eastern Washington and northern Idaho, and they also found two T-shirts inside the backpack that contained the bomb, one of which had a logo advertising the Relay for Life in Colville, clearly a link to anti-abortion activists who honed some of their, I'm sure, bomb planting and arsonist skills on abortion clinics. But I found it very interesting that the FBI can spend a lot of time and resources grooming 19-year-old kids in Portland on how to wire up an SUV. in order to realize their dreams of jihad, but they can't spend any time, apparently any time or money or resources in trying to track white supremacist groups who are suspected of domestic terrorism. When the media contacted a couple of white supremacists, two of the larger white supremacist groups in northern Idaho and eastern Washington, they asked them, has anyone from the FBI come to talk to you about this yet? And both groups said, no one's even called us.
Well, we don't know that for sure. It may be that the FBI is in fact grooming 19-year-olds in eastern Washington and learning how to build bombs. They're just not busting them.
that's right.
All right. Moving on, the legislature is in session and bills are being produced and promoted.
Yeah, the U.S. Congress in Washington, D.C.
Oh, no, state. Let's start with the state.
Yeah, the medical dispensary.
That's you. That's
yeah,
you,
I know.
Jeff.
That's sorry. That was the cue that Mike
right.
was giving.
Yes.
Anyway,
you have to jump in there.
I didn't have time. Anyway, let's start with the state and then we'll move on to the federal Congress. Hearing this week on a new bill in the Senate, and there's an identical bill in the House as well, SB 5073 and HB 1100, major new bills that are aimed at regulating and updating the code around medical marijuana dispensaries around the state. The 2007 law that now governs medical marijuana dispensaries has left huge gray areas in terms of what is and what isn't legal, both in terms of growing the pot, how to distribute it, how to get it to patients, protections for patients, and so forth. And so you had this bill which had a hearing this week that has a number of aspects to it. It would license growers and dispensaries. It clarifies who can be a designated provider and for how many people. It gives protection to patients in terms of protecting them from arrest and protecting them from employment discrimination. It allows people on probation to use medical marijuana, and that's a direct slap at Attorney General Rob McKenna, who has been aggressively trying to prosecute and put back in jail people who are on probation who are authorized to use medical marijuana because they're failing drug tests. Similarly, with employment discrimination, you have people who are failing drug tests for mandatory workplace, drug-free workplaces that are being fired or otherwise sanctioned against when they're in fact taking medicine has been prescribed by their doctor. So these are the kinds of problems that this bill is trying to address. And the hearing this week, interestingly enough, didn't get too much opposition, at least according to one of the main organizers behind it. And in particular, it did not get too much opposition, at least in the public, from law enforcement groups who in the past have expressed the most concerns about these sort of things. The biggest conflict that that appears to be likely to come up is around the employee discrimination issues, where there's conflict with federal requirements around workplace drug testing, that there may be conflicts with federal law in this area. But that's a relatively technical area that may be resolvable. So far, anyway, it looks relatively encouraging that this might be able to get a fair hearing, get through the Senate, get through the House. Organizers are looking for people to write senators, state senators in particular, in support of this bill. Again, it's SB 5073, and you can go online and find out who your local state senators are and urge them to support this bill, and also in the House, HB 1100. So it looks relatively positive, and it's a dramatic change in terms of the climate in Olympia of legislators being willing to consider this bill, even from where we were maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah, and I think one of the ironic things about this is it took a couple years when there are budget problems in Olympia to get them working on this issue. I think one of the main things driving it is that the state wants to license and tax medical marijuana dispensaries and growers. Because right now they exist in this kind of gray area. Medical marijuana dispensaries are businesses, sort of,
They're pharmacies, basically.
Yeah, they're pharmacies, basically, but they're also, they have to exist as collectives. They can't really market their goods to the public like a retail business can. They're in this gray area where they want to file and pay taxes. If they don't, they could be prosecuted for not paying their B&O taxes. And yet, if they do file and pay their taxes, they don't know what to call themselves, what rate to pay, and they're worried that they might be shut down as engaging in illegal activity. So it's interesting. It took a year where the legislature needs the extra money in B&O taxes and where medical marijuana dispensaries want to be legitimate for this to actually happen.
Yeah, and the other thing that this does is that either this year or next year, we're almost certainly going to see on the ballot a measure that would decriminalize marijuana entirely, and this gives another possibility for the state in terms of having an existing framework in place that would regulate and tax and provide for the distribution of decriminalized marijuana entirely.
Right.
All right. That takes us on to national and healthcare vote.
Yeah. How about Congress, Maria?
Now the U.S. Congress. Yes, the Republicans voted in the House, which they now control after the recent elections, to repeal the Obama bill for health care reform. And of course, that means that the Senate came back, which is controlled by Democrats, came back and said, well, we're not even going to consider a similar bill. So the legislation is dead on arrival. However, the Republicans in the House then said that they're going to push to try to cut the deficit by $2.5 trillion over the next 10 years. Of course, by doing that, they want to cut the discretionary budget. That means they would exclude any funding for the military or the two wars or the several other additional wars
although,
that we're fighting.
Although military spending is discretionary, too,
exactly.
Social Security and Medicare are not.
And they said they would leave Medicare and Social Security off the table, but they're also not going to even think about increasing taxes. Of course, the Bush tax cuts are what have led a big part of what have led to the current deficit.
And the rest of it is defense spending.
Yeah, to cut the deficit by $2.5 trillion over the next 10 years, they want to reduce the discretionary budget to 2006 levels and then freeze the budget with no annual adjustments for inflation. They want to slash the federal workforce by 15% and cancel raises for everyone else for 5 years, including any cost of living increases. And those initiatives would then effectively dismantle most government agencies. When you tell someone that you are going to freeze their salary and not give them a raise for 5 years, you have a very good chance of losing that person as an employee. That it also means when you cut budgets back to 2006 levels and you don't adjust for inflation, a lot of agencies are just not going to be able to operate. For example, Amtrak would probably have to close down. That's just one example of what would happen.
Yeah. The Nonpartisan Center for Budget and Policy Priorities actually issued an analysis this week of the House Republican Study Committee, and study should be in quotes, but the $2.5 trillion proposal. And it's a nonpartisan group that looks at the policy and budget implications of proposals like this one. And their review was not very favorable. The quote, in essence, the RSC proposal would eviscerate the vital services and benefits that the federal government provides and then improve the living standard and quality for life for millions of Americans. The cuts would, according to the center, raise unemployment massively and greatly weaken the economy. And one of the comments on this I particularly thought was trenchant. If lawmakers were to get together to plot how Congress could deliberately increase unemployment, their plan would look an awful lot like this.
Yes.
One.
And this week also the CBS and the New York Times did a poll of Americans. They asked them what they thought Congress's priorities should be. They also asked them about the budget. And two-thirds of Americans agree that they are willing to pay higher taxes to preserve Medicare and Social Security, although they said that the wealthy ought to be taxed more. And then asked to choose between Medicare, Social Security, and the Pentagon, an overwhelming majority said that Congress should cut money for the Pentagon and military spending. At the same time, they were asked what Congress should be focusing on. Only 18% said that they should even look at the healthcare issue. 43%, the vast the largest number, 43%, said that they need to focus on job creation. Well, the Republicans are doing the exact opposite. They're looking for ways to destroy jobs in Washington, D.C.
All right. Moving on, big merger this week.
Yeah, Comcast and NBC announcing that they, rather the Department of Justice approving the NBC-Comcast merger. The first time really that you have a major broadcast network being merged with one of the major cable providers in the country, so the content and delivery monopoly issues becoming a major, major issue. We don't have time to go into it too much, but it is very much a reminder of why you should support independent media, including things like KEXP and Mind Over Matters and Eat the State and good places like that, independent local media. The other interesting thing, of course, that happened with this is there's a lot of speculation that the Comcast merger was behind the sudden departure of Keith Olbermann from MSNBC last night. That is probably not directly accurate in the sense that you have two mega corporations joining. I imagine the executives of Comcast decide, okay, now that we're on the verge of taking over this very, very large corporation, the first thing we're going to do is get rid of Keith Olbermann. I doubt it worked like that, but you might have had the flip side happening, executives at MSNBC trying to curry favor with their new corporate bosses by cleaning house in advance of the new regime. So again, the chilling effects of mega corporations controlling much of American media and discourse.
All right, and a Gallup study.
Yeah, this week a Gallup study was released on world job markets where they noted that employment is picking up in countries like Britain, Germany, Japan, even in Russia. The employment market is getting better, but not here in the U.S. Conversely, here in the U.S., corporate profits are soaring way above what they are in places like Britain, Germany, Japan, and Russia. What's the difference? Well, an article in the New York Times looked at that issue, and they basically concluded that the difference is that, quote, American employers operate with few restraints, setting the terms of their relationship with employees. In other words, we don't have very many unions here, and U.S. employees are at a distinct disadvantage in trying to win wage increases and concessions and fewer work hours from their bosses than employees in just about any other developed country in the world.
Yeah, that also carries over to public policy because you have administrations, including the Obama administration, that become very business friendly because they don't get pressure from organized workers.
Yeah, and the courts are very business friendly as well. The article also goes on to note, quote, in study after study has shown that unions usually do benefit workers, end quote. And I just want to say, no kidding. It took this long and it took a downturn and it took a major study by the Gallup organization for you to realize that. Well, it might take a lot more for Obama to realize that. This week, he appointed as the head of his Economic Advisory Council, not someone who would necessarily create jobs, but somebody who is a major representative of industry, Jeffrey R. Immelt, who is the chairman and CEO of GE. Good going, President Obama.
All right, just a couple minutes left. Finally, talk developments in Haiti.
Yeah, developments in Haiti this week. Baby Doc Duvalier, Jean-Claude Duvalier, returned to the country in the midst of Haiti's problems with its elections, where it's not at all clear who the two candidates should be to go to the runoff election for president of Haiti. Jean-Claude Duvalier decided to make it his week to return to Haiti, and I guess he's trying to make a grab for that.
I think it's a perfect time for the Tonton Macoute, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, I just can't believe it. 25 years ago, he was driven from power. He and his father pretty much devastated the nation of Haiti in the 20th century. Massacring opponents, engaging in torture, rape, looting the public treasury, and now he's back for more.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Ja Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
They find it at www.eatthestate.org, where you can find commentary, and they have some stuff up there now on MLK Day and other stuff that's been going on. You can find humor and comics and all kinds of good things. If you have questions, comments, tips you'd like to write for us, we always appreciate that. Drop us a line. We're at editorial@eatthestate.org.